Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think of your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If you want to learn a new language, you absolutely should get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I absolutely love Babbel because their courses help me learn real-life conversational skills. It's so easy to learn how to order food, ask for directions, speak to the locals without having to consult language apps. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/SPP. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/SPP. That's spelled BABBEL.com/SPP. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Smart People Podcast, a podcast for smart people, where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people. Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Demp here. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the show, our guest is the one and only Charles Duhigg. You might know Charles from his other books, specifically The Power of Habit, which has spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, and also his book Smarter, Faster, Better, which was also a New York Times bestseller. His books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide. He's also pretty smart. He's a graduate of Yale University, Harvard Business School. He's a contributor to This American Life, NPR, and much more. And this week, we are talking to him about his brand new book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. I don't think anything else needs to be said, except I just want to call this out. Charles is actually a listener of the podcast, which I thought was so cool. He likes the show. He's been listening for quite some time. See, there are smart people among us. Hope you enjoy it. Share it with a friend. They've probably heard of Charles's work. And make sure to follow this podcast. Let's get into it. We are talking to Charles Duhigg about his brand new book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Enjoy. We're going to talk about the new book, Super Communicators, but I have to start out. I have you on. I know you through The Power of Habit. So I have to just ask you some, not about the content, but about the whole experience.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
I would love to know from your perspective, the difference in your life from before you wrote that to after you wrote it.
Oh, it was, I mean, so two things happened in 2013, right? I won a Pulitzer Prize for this series I'd written about Apple in the New York Times. And then that same year, The Power of Habit came out. And for years, I mean, I've been a journalist for like 20 years now, actually a little bit longer. And for years, I figured like when I win the Pulitzer Prize, it's going to be life changing. And it was not life changing at all. But writing The Power of Habit was absolutely life changing.
Really?
I mean, yeah. I mean, just... And you know this from talking to folks, from experiences you've had yourself, like when you do something that touches so many people, it just kind of opens up the world in a way that's really just wonderful. And a big part of that like wonderfulness is just getting to hear from people who say, I read your book and it, you know, it changed my life this way, or it helped me with that. But yeah, it was really, I mean, there's basically before Power of Habit and after Power of Habit. And I just feel so lucky to have had that.
There are a few authors that have at least one book that does what Power of Habit did, that reaches as many people, that has the accolades, that sells through that much. I also know a lot of people who want to write books. And so I'm curious, you know, both of the positive of what that was like, but also what is not seen from the average person on how, despite success, our lives are still similar afterwards.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Well, I'll say, I think there's two things about writing a book that people often don't realize until they do it, and sometimes don't realize until well after. And the first is that being a good writer is actually very important. And that doesn't mean necessarily putting together pretty sentences. What it means is understanding how the structure of a chapter works, or how to tell a story in a way that's compelling, how to report, right? Many people write books that are based on their own ideas. And I'm certain that their ideas are super interesting for at least one or two, sometimes three chapters. But if you don't go and report other people's ideas, you really don't have enough for a book. So that's one thing, is that, you know, by the time I wrote Power of Habit, I had been a professional writer for 10 years, where I was writing every single day for newspapers and magazines. And that's really, really important. The second thing I would say is, when you publish the book, that means that you are 50% done with your job. And a lot of people don't think about the other 50%, but I think of publishing a book as basically starting a small company. And if you opened an ice cream parlor and you were like, okay, first day of business, like I imagine most of the people are going to come in on the first day of business and I'm just going to stop working now that I've got the ice cream parlor open, you'd go broke, right?
Yeah, yeah,
like the whole point of opening an ice cream parlor is what you do on day two and three and 300 and 400 and 500. And a book is basically the same way, that that if you're doing it right, you're spending years trying to help people learn that your book exists. And so those two things, so I think that sometimes like we look at success and we think like, oh, like when you're successful, you get to relax, but it's actually the opposite. When you're successful, you have to work more to take advantage of that success. Like if you love doing something, sort of the punishment of being successful is you have to do it all the time. And so honestly, like after Power of Habit came out, I was so much more busy and so much more stressed.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. That year that it came out was like one of the hardest years of my life. Just because I was so lucky and there were so many opportunities and I felt like I had to take advantage of all of them. And it really just totally wore me down, which I can feel fortunate for.
When you accomplish something like that, how much does the fear of never getting there again follow you?
I mean, I think the first thing is that you don't know that something's successful until well after it's successful. Right. Like, so like Power of Habit did well its first week and its first month. And then we had two good months and then three good months. And it wasn't really until like month 13 that I was like, oh, this is actually a success. Right. Like, because you figure at some point it will end, and it does at some point end. And you work hard to try and, you know, extend it as long as you can. But it's not like you wake up one morning and you're like, now you're a success. By the time you sell your company for $100 million, or by the time you get the award for doing something great, you've been working at that thing for years and years and years. And so I don't know that it's a fear of never getting that chance again as much as a sense of an obligation to take advantage of this, of your luck and of this opportunity that's been provided to you, and to never know, like, you know, sometimes you inevitably reach a point where you can't say yes to everything. And there is this anxiety about like, am I saying no to the wrong things? Because the other thing is like, I have no idea what sold the Power of Habit. I have no idea what's going to sell this book, Super Communicators. Like you do everything you can and some of it breaks through, and some of it that you think will absolutely break through has no impact at all.
Looking back, do you not know what it was about that book?
I have some hunches, yeah. Right? Like we had an excerpt in the New York Times Magazine because I was working at the Times at that point. And it was about how Target was basically using habits to spy on its customers and figure out if someone's pregnant. And that got a lot of attention. And then I did a number of podcasts and I was on Fresh Air. I was on the Today Show. I think that those things move the needle. But I've also seen a bunch of other shows or a bunch of other books that have done exactly the same thing and have not broken through. And so honestly, like it's kind of like what they used to say about advertising, like 50% of advertising is wasted. The problem is you never know which 50% it is, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So you have to do 100% of it. And I think that's kind of not just book publishing. I think that's true of life. There's this phrase that I actually learned from Jim Collins, the guy who wrote Good to Great, known as a serendipity tax, which is like, you don't know when serendipity is going to strike. And so you have to go to a lot of things where it does not strike. And that's the tax you pay for that moment when you're at a dinner and someone brings up an idea and that becomes Good to Great, or that show that like you've never heard of before and they ask you to be on and you go on and suddenly their fans are like proselytizing about you. Like you don't know where success is going to come from. And so the only thing you can control is putting yourself in as many situations where hopefully it comes to you.
But to your point, then the anxiety inducing effect of what do I say yes and no to when it's all there. It reminds me of, are you familiar with Annie Duke's book?
Yeah. I know Annie really well.
Oh, do you? So like the idea of you can focus on the process, but the results in most things in life, you got to let go of. And I would imagine your work more than almost any. Ours as well, you know, the in podcasting or any real content creation, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that like, and in part it's because you can't control the outcome, right? You can get a bad draw of cards and be unlucky. You can get a great draw of cards and the guy across the table from you has even better cards and you don't know until he turns them over. You can write an amazing book. I have a friend who wrote a beautiful, wonderful book that came out on September 12th, 2001. And as you can imagine, nobody wanted to talk about like some random book on September 12th, 2001. And but it's a beautiful book and she just got unlucky and that just happens in life. So what you have to do is you have to focus on the thing you can control, which is the choices you're making, the process you use, and just working as hard and as truthfully as you can.
What led you, say, to Power of Habit? And then there's the 2.0 version, right? Which is what you've done since then and what we're going to talk about.
Super communicators,
you know, yeah. Yeah, walk me through, you know, deciding to be a journalist and what that's like.
Sure. So I was, after I graduated from college, I started a company back in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I grew up. And we built medical education campuses. And I got a couple of years into building that company and realized I really didn't know enough about how to build a company. And so I decided to go to business school. And so I applied to business schools and I got into Harvard Business School and I enrolled there. And about halfway through my first year, we sold the company. And so at that point, I was confronted by this choice, which was, do I go back to New Mexico? Do I start another company and go into business? And at that point, I was interested in going into politics. Or I had been a journalist in college and just really liked writing and liked other journalists. And so the summer between first and second year of business school, I went and I worked with this private equity firm back in Albuquerque. And my job was basically to build spreadsheets. And so I'd build spreadsheet after spreadsheet after spreadsheet. And it was kind of boring. And in order to entertain myself, I would allow myself to listen to one This American Life. Or if it was a really tough day, I'd listen to two This American Lives.
Wow. Okay.
Because I didn't want to run out of them.
Yeah.
And at the end of the summer, I realized that the best part of each day was listening to This American Life. And I was like, if that's true, I should probably go try and make This American Lives, right? I should probably become a journalist. And so my second year of business school, I really focused on becoming a journalist. And I got an internship after I graduated with the Washington Post for just the summer. I was the lowest paid member of my class from HBS. I think I earned like $9,000, like $3,000 a month. It was like, it was ridiculous. And then luckily I got hired by the LA Times and then the New York Times. But this thing happened where we were living in New York and we were, my wife is pregnant. We were going to have our first kid. And I had like 40 grand in savings. Like that was all the money I had, which in New York is not enough to do anything. Like you can't buy a house. You can't do anything. And so I was like, I got to somehow earn more money. And I figured I'd write a book. And so that's what I did. But at this, then I was like, well, so what book should I write? And I sat down and I basically said, well, look, the biggest problem I have is that, you know, I have all these fancy degrees and I'm successful. And like, I cannot get myself to go running in the morning. Like I cannot get myself to diet. I'm 20 pounds overweight and I feel powerless to change that, which doesn't, if I'm so smart, like why can't I do that? And I figured, okay, so here's my plan for a book. I don't know if it's going to sell any copies, but basically I'm going to call experts and tell them I'm writing a book and then ask them to solve my problem for me.
Welcome to my podcast, by the way.
Yeah, and it totally works, right? It does. Super Communicators, the book that just came out.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Right.
Like basically like when I was a manager at the New York Times, I discovered that I was really good at logistics. And the place where I kept screwing up was communication. And of course, communication is the most important part of being a leader or being a manager. And I communicate for a living. I couldn't figure out why I was so bad at it. And so the same way I was like, I'm going to call experts and ask them to solve my problem. And hopefully those solutions will be interesting enough that it justifies a book. And it did.
This episode is brought to you by Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Head over to factormeals.com/smart50 and use the code SMART50 to get 50% off. That's code SMART50, SMART50, at factormeals.com/smart50 to get 50% off.
I think there's something to be said, though, about the willingness to admit, like, the answer's out there. I don't need to have it. I just need to go find it. And then in your case, to then leverage your strengths of writing and communicating to get the message across in a way that people wanted to accept it.
I don't think anyone has actually a new idea as a brainstorm that's a great idea. I think what happens again and again and again is that you basically want to like steal someone else's idea or learn from someone else, or you want to imitate what someone else has done. And as you get deeper and deeper into it, you realize like, oh, the way that I do this is actually different from the way that they did this. And the creativity and innovation basically emerges almost organically through the process of learning. And so if you sit in a room and you're like, I'm going to come up with a great idea today, I don't think you're going to come up with a great idea. But if you go out and you say like, I want to ask, you know, accounting how they do their job to see if I can use any of that in my marketing division, you're going to hear some things that get your wheel spinning. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, you're going to have an idea that's new, and it won't even seem new to you because you've seen it every step of the way. And you think of it as someone else's idea that you've brought over. But when you show it to other people, they'll say, no, that's a new idea. Like, you have changed this thing enough that it's new.
Somewhere along the line, I heard somebody define innovation as
just the coming together of disparate ideas or something. And yeah. I remember, okay, that makes sense. It happens daily. I mean, when you do what you do or I do this, and there's this constant influx of information, I don't think I remember all of the points or everything that I hear, but I know it is forming the way I process the world. And
totally.
I like that because I think that the input I'm putting in are experts, are people who have dedicated their lives to it type thing.
Yeah. And by the way, I kind of try to formalize this when I'm like writing a magazine article, because it usually takes like 6 months to write a magazine article. And so what I'll do is I do a whole bunch of interviews, and then like I'll be driving home and I'll have this idea like, oh, this is a clever way to explain this one idea, or here's a good line. And I'll just email it to myself. And then I put it in this folder and literally never look at it again.
I love it. Yes.
But the point is, it's not so much that like that line is so good because I'm not ready to write yet. It's that like by thinking about it, by letting my brain process it, by even formalizing it, by typing it out on my phone, like I'm just basically making that knowledge easier to access. And eventually it comes out the other end in the form it's supposed to.
That's what I do. The exact same. I email myself. I have a folder. I'm with you. And somebody once told me, I thought that I was procrastinating. And they said, well, what are you doing in that time? And I said, well, I'm either consciously thinking of it or I'll just revisit it. And they said, yeah, so you're probably not putting it off. You're just allowing your brain and your subconscious time to kind of connect these dots that you can't do intentionally. I was like, whoa.
And if you, so the new book, Super Communicators, which is all about communication, like that's basically how communication works also, right? Like you can go into a conversation with some topics you want to discuss. And in fact, the conversation will be better if you do. But at some point, the conversation just takes on a life of its own. And you're talking about something that you didn't plan on talking about, or you're talking about it in a way that you didn't understand it earlier. And like, the amazing thing about our brain is there's the conscious part of our brain, right? And then there's the rest of our brain, which is the bulk of our brain, that basically takes care of stuff in the background. And part of being human and part of being smart is learning to let your brain do what it does well, almost kind of hacking your own brain by not trying to force it to do everything deliberately and consciously, but rather like to be in a conversation and let that conversation flow, because we know that there's a part of our brain that intuits where this should go, what I want out of this conversation, what you want out of this conversation. And if we just go in with like a note card where we're like, here's the four things we're going to discuss, you're going to miss a lot of that.
I want to touch on that. This idea of intuiting a conversation. I was talking to a good friend of mine the other day. And he said, Chris, I remember the first time you told me that you don't write down most of your questions for your podcast. He said, I thought that sounded weird and that kind of lazy. He said, and years later, now that I listen, number one, I don't know how you do that. And number two, I think that makes the show better. Do you think the ability to trust yourself in a conversation is a learned skill?
Well, okay. So I think the answer is yes, but let me explain what I mean by that. So one of the ideas in Super Communicators is that there's essentially these three kinds of conversations that most discussions fall into one of these three buckets, and oftentimes more than one as we go through a conversation. There's these practical conversations, right, where we need to make a decision or we need to talk about something practical. There's emotional conversations where the goal in that conversation is not to make a plan or to solve a problem. It's to just explain how we feel and to share how we feel. And then there's social conversations, and social conversations are really about how we relate to other people. And so I think one of the things that happens, and I do think that the more we practice this, the better we get at it, is that what we know is that if people are having different kinds of conversations at the same time, they'll basically fail to connect. That's when miscommunication occurs. So if I'm having an emotional conversation, and you match me with an emotional conversation, then you're a super communicator. We're aligning. And what we know is that if we could see inside our brains, we would actually see at that moment we're having the same kind of conversation, that our brain activity would basically start to mirror each other. And this is the goal of communication, right? Is to, I have an idea. I want to share the idea with you. I want your brain to kind of look a little bit like my brain, because that's what understanding the idea or the emotion or the social concept is. And so I think one of the things that happens is that by not over-preparing, you're putting yourself in a place where you're forcing yourself to pay attention to what kind of conversation your guest is having. And that allows you to match much better. And this is actually, in psychology, this is actually known as the matching principle. And it's at the core of how we communicate. The super communicators pay attention to how other people are communicating, what kind of conversation is occurring, and then they know how to match them. And so I think what's happening, and tell me if this lines up with your lived experience, is that by preparing enough, but then stepping back from the preparation, you're allowing yourself to really listen to your guest and therefore match them.
Exactly. That was the issue, actually. If I had too many questions written down and I had done too much research, there was this almost ticking checklist, like you got to get to all those things. That was a really good thought. And it distracted me from being able to pivot in where I feel like I go now. And I'm always trying to get better at it, is when I feel this like usefulness or giddiness or excitement in a statement, then I just want to go deeper there.
And so you can listen to your own experiences, what kind of conversation you want to have. You can share that. And this listening part is really important. So there's this thing known as deep questions. Like one of the easiest ways to figure out what kind of conversation the other person is seeking and actually what kind of conversation you want is to ask a deep question. And a deep question is something that just asks someone to talk about their values or their beliefs or their experiences. It doesn't have to be overly intimate, right? It can be as simple as saying like, oh, you're a lawyer. Like, did you always want to be a lawyer? Which is basically an invitation for someone to talk about their past and why they made this decision to become a lawyer and how they see the law. Or it could be something as simple as just saying like, oh, it's interesting that you brought up like your family. Like, tell me a little bit about like, what does your family mean to you? Like, if you ask that question, what does X mean to you, which is like the uber deep question, the other person basically will tell you what they want to talk about, right? Because they might answer that question by saying, actually, my family is really tough because one of my kids isn't doing well in school and I'm thinking about like how I get him into like a tutoring program. So that's a kind of practical conversation. Or they might be like, you know, like, I just love my kids so much. And like, you know, one of them just went to college and it's so hard being away from them. That's clearly a social or an emotional conversation. Or maybe they talk about how their kids are getting along with their friends. And like, and that's a social conversation. Asking a deep question invites the other person to tell us what they really want to talk about. And once they do, it feels wonderful to match them, right? Like if they say something emotional, and you say something emotional back, you basically can't help but like each other. Like it's literally hardwired in our brain. It's known as emotional contagion. And if we do that, if we have reciprocal emotionality, then we basically trust and like the other person more. And they trust and like us.
And given how much of what we're doing in the world is built on that, right? It's either influencing or bonding or commiserating. It's emotional connections amongst humans. I know that's why I love the subtitle, by the way, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Not communication, not whatever, but connection, I think, is just the key point here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also not about like, it's not just about you, right? It's not like this is how you become a super communicator, because the way you become a super communicator is by connecting with other people, listening to them, right? Being able to hear what they're really saying to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we connect.
This term super communicators, me and my dad always joke, like my mom has this really strange ability to just befriend everyone.
Yeah.
And her superpower is she is interested in everyone. She will come back and say how this person is the most interesting person in the world and just go down the line. And ultimately, it's what you're talking about. It's the ability to show up in a relationship and say that this person, just for who they are, has something to offer and I want to understand it.
That's absolutely right. And my guess is, okay, so let me ask some questions about your mom, because it sounds like your mom is a very natural super communicator. My guess is not only is she interested in other people, she lets them know that she's interested in them. She proves to them that she's listening to what they have to say.
But almost sometimes to the point where we'll have to say like, Ma, they're not that great. And she's like, no, but listen, here's their whole background. Yeah.
And let me ask you this. Does your mom laugh a lot?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things, so there's a couple of things we know about super communicators, people who are, all of us are super communicators at one time or another, but some people do it much more consistently than others. And it's just a learned skill. So one of the things that we know about them is that they laugh way more than other people. But what's important is they don't laugh at something funny. They just laugh because actually 80% of the time we laugh, it's not in response to humor. It's because we want to show the other person that we want to connect with them.
Oh,
and when they laugh back, they're showing us that they accept, they want to connect with us as well. So my guess is that she laughs more than the average person. The other thing that she probably does, and tell me if this is right, is she probably asks a lot of questions. So super communicators ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person. But what's interesting is you don't really register the questions, a lot of them, because they're not like formal, like, tell me about your childhood. They're like, oh, that's in, like, tell me more about that. Oh, what did you think after he said that? Oh, yeah, what'd you do next? There are these little questions that we hardly even register and that, again, are just a learned skill. Like, you can learn to do this. But those questions basically make the other person feel like you're really listening, you're really interested. It's not enough to be interested in other people. You have to prove to them that you're listening to them. You have to prove to them that you're interested. And the ways we do that is through laughter, through asking questions, through asking deep questions. Like, it feels wonderful to be asked a deep question. And then oftentimes there's this thing called looping for understanding, where if we repeat back to someone what they said to us, then they feel listened to, they feel heard. And particularly if you're in a tough conversation, like a conversation with conflict, then if you do this, the looping for understanding actually has three steps. There's asking a question, repeating back in your own words what the person just said, which a lot of us do naturally. But then the third step is the most important step, asking them if you got it right. And in a case where you're having a tough conversation or there's some conflict going on, if you repeat back what they just said to you in your own words, and then you say, can you tell me if I got that right? One of two things is going to happen, probably both of them. Number one, if you didn't get it right, they're going to tell you and explain what they really mean, which is really useful. But number two, they're going to feel like you actually want to understand them. And you're proving to them that you're listening. And that's critically important. Listening itself is not enough. Showing someone you're listening is what matters.
Why? Why do we care so much about that?
I think it's our deep-seated need to feel connected. The reason the human species is the human species, why the reason we've been so successful is because of our ability to communicate, right? Like, communication is essentially a superpower. And the way that our ability to communicate has evolved in our brain is it's created what's known as prosocial instincts. It's created this feeling where when you connect with another person, it makes you feel good. Now, there's no logical reason why you should feel good simply because you think another person understands you. But actually, our brain has evolved to encourage connection and encourage communication by making us feel good when it goes well. And so when I say something and you prove to me that you're listening, you prove to me that you want to connect, that we are connecting, it actually makes me feel good. It actually causes a serotonin release in my brain that makes me feel good. And there's an evolutionary reason for this. Like, that's how you build communities. That's how you build pair bonding among spouses. That's why we care about our children and our neighbors. And so the reason why it's so important to prove that we're listening is because that actually is the goal of communication, is to create that sense of connection. Our brain feels better. And so if I'm listening and you don't know that I'm listening, the conversation is just going to be less rewarding for you.
Although on its face, that makes all the sense in the world. What about how so much of our life is spent communicating in a way that is data transfer?
So I think there is this kind of conversation, which is the practical conversation, where data transmission is actually the point. And so it feels good to share data as long as you know that the other person is receiving it, right? As long as they're proving to you that they're listening to you instead of just waiting their turn to speak by showing that they received your data. But I think the other part of that, of what you're saying, is that there's a lot of conversations. So when we have a discussion, it's not just a practical conversation or an emotional conversation or a social conversation. It's usually all three at different periods. And so one of the things that often happens is that, take for instance, at work, I bring in an idea to my boss, and my boss says, okay, here's what I hear you saying. I totally understand it. That makes a lot of sense. And then he says, great job. So what's just happened is we've had a practical conversation about the idea, and then we've shifted to an emotional conversation where he or she has praised me, right? That's emotional. And if I match that and kind of come back and say, thank you so much, that it feels so good to know that you like this idea, that's when it might seem to an outsider like it was all about data transmission. But actually, you as a participant, you know that like it was data transmission, but then it was emotional. And then maybe your boss is like, look, you did such a good job. I want you to take the leadership role on this. And let's talk about how to manage your peers if you're in a leadership role and you're leading them. That's a social conversation, right? And so every discussion might seem like one thing, but it's almost always more than one thing.
Being able to dance, therefore, is the super communicator.
Yes, that is exactly right. Being able to dance and to understand what the other person's offering you and matching them or inviting them to match you. And those are just, again, learned skills. This is like nobody's born a super communicator. This is just something you can practice and get better at.
What is the greatest inhibitor of becoming or being a super communicator?
I think there's two of them. The first is getting too much in your own head, right? Like, if you're up in your own head and you're like, here's the four things I want to say, and I really need to say these four things, you're not in a mindset where you're listening to the other person, and you're kind of sending them a signal that they don't necessarily need to listen to you. And they might be talented enough that they listen nonetheless, but like, if it's all about like, here's what I want to say, that gets in our own way. And then the other thing that I think gets in our own way is just being worried about the conversation. So there's been a lot of interesting studies, including the study out of Harvard, which I love, about how people end conversations, right? And it turns out that ending a conversation is like pretty much the easiest thing on earth. Like there's like 1,000 ways to end a conversation, from being like, oh, well, you know, I see you got other people that you want to talk to at this party. Go, like, I don't want to take up all your time, to like just being like, oh, that's so interesting. And then just picking up your book and reading your book, right? Like there's ending a conversation is really easy, it turns out, and people are masters at it. But at the beginning of a conversation, many people are anxious about how the conversation will end, particularly if it's a conversation with a stranger. They're worried they'll get trapped in a conversation and that won't be able to get out of it, or it's going to be awkward. And so people bring a lot of anxiety to conversations. And part of being a super communicator is just understanding, like, there's a couple of principles, a couple of rules that if I apply them, like, I don't need to feel anxious at all. And the book basically explains what those rules are. That's kind of the point of the book. And so I think if we can, number one, enter a conversation, and we refer to this as a learning conversation. If you're having a learning conversation, you're going to be just fine. And a learning conversation means, I want to explain who I am, but I also want to understand who you are. I want to listen to you. And I know that I don't have to be anxious about it, because I have all the tools I need to start and get out of this conversation when I want, then basically conversations are going to be pretty good.
Why do we need tools if it's hardwired into us?
Well, so there are a number of instincts that are hardwired into us, right? And keep in mind, though, that a lot of those instincts evolved over millions of years when we lived in very different societies. certainly not societies with text messaging and Facebook and sending emails.
And with so many people at our disposal.
And so many people. And certainly not in societies. I mean, you know, as little as like 200 years ago, you basically saw the same 30 people every single day and never saw anyone new. Nowadays, you get on the bus, you get on the subway, you walk into a new coffee shop. So part of it is just taking these instincts and just updating them a little bit for the modern world. But the other part of it is that, you know, we all have instincts that we basically train ourselves to ignore, right? Like, I have an instinct to only eat healthy food. Like, my body likes healthy food, and yet I will eat a hamburger every day of the week, right? I know my instinct is not to waste time doom scrolling on the internet.
Yeah.
And yet I will doom scroll on the internet. Yeah. So just because we have an instinct doesn't mean we don't need to learn the skill to allow that instinct to come out.
Yeah, that's a great point. And even the reason I asked is because it's funny you were mentioning the anxiety about ending a conversation. We had our holiday party last night, and I work at a massive company. And so there were hundreds of people, and I knew maybe a dozen. And there was this constant, ooh, do I want to get pinned over there? And then if I go up here and they just walk by, maybe if I pause, I won't meet them in the elevator type thing. And not like to a bad degree, but just the recognition of our intentionality between how and when we choose to connect and the reasons and the stories we'll create in our brain around that connection.
Yeah. That's exactly. So, and I'll tell you, like, one of the best skills for overcoming that kind of anxiety is, and this is from a study that was done by a guy named Michael Yeomans, who's at the Imperial College in London. So if you, before you go into that party, if you literally jot down three things you could talk about, and then you also jot down what you're going to do to end a conversation, and you put that card in your back pocket, it'll take you like 10 seconds to write this, right? You put that card in your back pocket. What all the studies show is you actually probably won't talk about those three things very much. And you'll end the conversation in other ways that are more natural. But feeling like you're prepared will lower your anxiety enormously. Because oftentimes what anxiety comes from is anxiety comes from the unknown. Right? I'm going to get stuck in this conversation and I don't know what I'm going to say next. I don't know what we're going to talk about next. I don't know how I'm going to stop this from being boring. I don't know how I'm going to end the conversation. If you answer those questions, the answers you choose ahead of time might not be the answers you need at that moment. You might find other answers on your own, but just removing the unknown part of it, that changes everything.
I love that. And I really love the idea of ending a conversation. I'm so glad you brought that up because I've never thought about it consciously, but I've definitely thought about it subconsciously. Last night, I could have, if I would have had this conversation with you prior to, I would have just wrote down, you know, hey, I'm going to grab some food because there's food everywhere, you know, but in my head at the time, or even now, it's like, well, Chris, that's not true. That's a little bit of a lie, but like, it's a social norm just to make sure we both feel good about the interaction. You know what I mean?
Or even just like, I often go to parties and like, well, I'll chat with someone for a while. And I'm like, look, I know that you came here. There's probably a ton of people you need to talk to. So I don't want to take up all of your time. Right. Like, which is like the nicest way to be like, okay, let's end the conversation now. Like, nobody feel like you're kind of complimenting the other person. Like, they're so busy. You don't want to like take up all their time. Like, it's not hard to come up with these things or to do them. It's just that if we haven't come up with them, we feel anxious.
Exactly. To your point, I think often what we do is we know that something is causing that social anxiety, but we don't say, wait, what is it? How can I negate it or minimize it? How do I solve? We just go, okay, because I know it's there, that's enough almost. But then we just tolerate that feeling. I love what you're doing. You're taking something that is human communication. Also, every person listening at one point or another has been nervous about some aspect of that conversation. Identify it, come up with a simple enough solution prior to, and watch that, I'm going to call it social anxiety, melt to some degree.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And honestly, like what study after study shows is you won't even use the solution you came up with. You'll use something else that feels more natural, but having that solution empowers you to find that other thing.
There's a couple of things I want to ask you. One is, I heard in an interview you say that although your job as a journalist is to interview people, that actually didn't make you a great communicator. And you talked about the difference between an interview and a conversation. And that is something that I have been thinking about for a decade because of this podcast. I don't like to interview people. I just don't. I don't like to interview. I want to have a conversation. Feels better. To your point, how I'm perceived by the other person matters to me. So I want them to leave saying, I enjoyed that. Here's the problem. In this medium, technically, my responsibility is to the listener, which might be better served through an interview. What is your thinking around this? Maybe it's in your writing or when you're interviewing somebody to turn it into a writing. How do you tackle this to maybe serve both parties, the person you're talking to and the person who's consuming it?
So it's a really, really good question. And one of the nice things about writing, but this is also true in audio, is the ability to edit means you can do something different in the interview than what appears on the page or in the published podcast. So let's talk about what the difference between an interview and a conversation is. In an interview, when I go in to do an interview, my goal is to actually be colorless. Like I want to shine a spotlight on the other person. I want to understand who they are, and I want them to have all the latitude to share with me who they are. And so oftentimes I'll spend a huge amount of time with someone that I'm writing about, and afterwards they'll say something like, I actually have no idea who he is. Like, I don't know who Charles is. I don't feel particularly connected to him. But from my perspective, I've gotten everything I need. And then they read the piece and then they feel connected because they're like, Jesus, Charles, like, listened to everything I was saying. So that's an interview. A conversation is very different. A conversation involves at least two people who are both there and present and equally participating in the dialogue. And in that case, sharing your thoughts is actually critical because it draws out of the other person things that they might not have said otherwise, right? And the things that they say only make sense in the context of the conversation. So what I would say is, I think you're doing it exactly right. Like, I think listening to conversations is much more fun than listening to interviews.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask you, by the way.
Yes.
You
know, listen to podcasts. I love listening to conversations. Okay. I think it's like so much more interesting. And when I used to host a podcast, I tried to make them conversations. I think that also the ability to edit means that if you go off on a riff about yourself that like is very important to our dialogue that helps me understand you, you can also clip that out.
Which I have absolutely done. Yeah.
Which is the magic of editing.
Yeah.
But in this moment, in the conversation we're having, you being a part of this is really important. Like it's what prompts me not to just like, you know, go off my like script about like, here's the three things I want to say about the book.
That is my point. So honestly, this might've just been asking for justification from somebody who I respect the work and everything you've done. But in truth, it's the one thing I try to do is have a conversation that hasn't been had a million times. And I'm sure you've done that. You've been on these media tours where you answer the same thing a million times. And
totally.
In my perspective, I just don't know why I would want to add more of that noise to the world.
And there's these things called satellite tours, where what you do is you sit in a room and you talk to like radio station after radio station and TV station, like 30 or 40 in one day for about 5 minutes apiece. And in those ones, you do like everybody, the host and you, wants everyone to be on message, right? Like, you've got 5 minutes. There's no time for like exploration. How's your day going? Like, it's not a conversation. It's a back and forth. But for something like this, you're exactly right that like the reason your listeners tune in, I think, is because they want to learn something new, something that they don't get from that 5 minute.
Yeah, that's a great point. I know we're running out of time. The last thing I wanted to ask is, I'm always fascinated. You are the one that has lived the experience of writing Super Communicators for a long time. And in the book, you talk about going out to experts. And, you know, you talk to a lot of fascinating people in really, it could be a courtroom, et cetera. Which one to you do you feel added the most color to this book?
So I think there's two things I would say. The first is, there's so many stories that were so fascinating. There's a story of how, of like a CIA officer who's trying to recruit overseas agents. And I just loved that story. There's the story you mentioned of a jury deliberation where one of the jurors basically like was a super communicator and figured out how to get everyone around a verdict. Or there's the story like the making of the Big Bang, the Big Bang Theory,
the TV show.
Yeah. So basically there was all this communication stuff they had to do to make that show work, or like how NASA recruits astronauts, or how Netflix. So there's so many stories that like for me were so important because they're just wonderful stories. They're just so much fun to read. But I'd say that the story that's had the most impact on me is actually a story about myself, which is, I would have this pattern that would happen again and again, and I think it's pretty typical in relationships. I would like come home from work after having like a tough day, and I would like complain to my wife and be like, my boss doesn't understand me and my colleagues don't appreciate me and yada, yada, yada. And my wife would respond with a very practical advice. She would say like, look, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and you can get to know each other a little better, and that'll probably help smooth over some of the problems. And instead of hearing what she was saying, I would get even more upset. I'd be like, why aren't you supporting me? I want you to take my side. You should be outraged on my behalf. And it wasn't until I started reporting this book and someone explained to me what was going on that I understood the problem, which was, they said, look, you are having an emotional conversation and your wife is having a practical conversation. And both conversations are equally valid. But if you're having different kinds of conversations at the same time, then neither of you will feel listened to or connected. And they were like, if you say something emotional, like you need to help your wife understand that she should respond emotionally. And when she says something practical, you should get into a practical mindset and like start matching her. And there's actually in schools, the way that they teach this is they tell teachers, if you have a student who comes up and they're like worked up about something, ask them, do you want to be heard? Do you want to be helped, or do you want to be hugged? And those are basically the three different kinds of conversations, right? And like, if you ask a student that and they say like, I want to be hugged, then they're saying, I don't want you to solve my problem. I don't want you to help me. I want you to make me feel better, right? Or if they say, I want you to hear what I'm saying, then they're, or I want you to help me, then they're saying, I want a practical conversation. Let's figure out the solution. So my wife and I actually use this with each other all the time. Now, we'll say it in conversation like, do you want me to help you solve this? Or do you want to just tell me how you're feeling? And it's not an offensive question at all, right? Like the other person is like, no, I want you to just listen to how I'm feeling. Like, and then you know how to match them. So with all the stories in the book, and there's tons of stories in the book, the one that's impacted me the most is actually basically how my wife and I learned to talk to each other. And well, it's been really powerful.
I mean, tell me about a more important, you know, output of writing a book on communication than bettering, you know, the relationship with your spouse. I can hear spouses across the globe right now, you know, working out the issues because heard, helped, hugged. I wrote them down. I'm going to use it, you know, because I tend to go straight into help mode. Like, oh, totally. Well, we can solve that, you know, but heard, helped, hugged, we can remember that one.
Yeah. No, it's, and they're just like, again, we all have this instinct. We all, as soon as we hear it, we know how true it is. It's just that sometimes we need something, we need a lesson to remind us to let that instinct out.
You can also, I would imagine, put the onus on the person speaking. If your wife walked up to you and said, hey, Charles, I really just want you to understand how I feel about this. Boom. Then that would, right?
It makes a huge difference. Like, yeah. Something that bothers me and I want to explain to you what it is. I don't need you to solve it for me. I just want you to help, like, listen to me.
Yeah.
It, who doesn't appreciate hearing that?
Exactly. Right? It's like, oh, like, good. Whew, I know what to do here. Yeah.
Now I know how to win at this conversation. Like, I know how to kill it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. I love it. Well, like you said, you know, in the same vein as the books you've written, which are my favorite type, as somebody who only reads nonfiction, you weave in the stories to make it feel like a story, not like a textbook. And so Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection, out now as the time of this interview coming out. So excited for it. You know, really appreciate you being on. Love your work. Big fan. For those listening, obviously, we're going to link to the book, Charles. Where else? You know, I know you do a lot of writing and communicating. So where else do you want people to go?
Yeah. So if you just Google my name, Charles Duhigg, my website will come up and it has like a ton of stuff. I will also mention my email address is charles@charlesduhigg.com. So if anyone emails me at charles@charlesduhigg.com, I will absolutely not only read your email, I will reply to it. Like,
that's,
I feel
a bold,
like,
claim.
It's so I've replied to over 21,000 so far. Ooh. And it's easier than it sounds. Like, I, it's, guess, not like a huge time suck, but I feel like if somebody invests like their time and money in reading my book or my writing and then write me an email, like, you kind of owe it to them to write them back. And I also find it's like one of the most rewarding parts of my job or my life is to hear from people and to be able to dialogue with them. So yeah, you can find me online. You can email me at charles@charlesduhigg.com. And I will definitely write back.
And I have to say, Charles, just before we go, you just gave people, I think, a bigger piece of advice than you realize, which is people are more accessible than you might seem.
Yeah.
I know for us, and we haven't written The Power of Habit or Super Communicators, but like when we get an email, I first go, I genuinely go, imagine that person with all the things they have going on in their life said, I'm going to pause to email them and give them feedback or kudos or whatever. I genuinely think about that. And so you're saying the same and you respond. It's incredible.
Everyone basically leads the same life. Right? Like, it doesn't matter how fancy you are. It doesn't matter how special you are. Like, you still like hearing from other people. You still check your email in the morning.
There you go.
It's a great way to procrastinate the start of the day.
It is. Life tip.
And yeah. And if you get an email from a reader who says, like, hey, tell me about X or I love Y.
Yeah.
It makes you happy.
That's awesome. Charles, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
A special thank you to our guest, Charles Duhigg, one of my absolute favorite authors of all time. As always, the episode was hosted by Chris Stemp and produced by yours truly, John Rojas. Charles's book, Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection, is available now wherever books are sold. Jumping into the quick housekeeping items, if you ever want to reach out to the show, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter @smartpeoplepod. And of course, if you want to stay up to date with all things Smart People Podcast, head over to the website, smartpeoplepodcast.com, and sign up for the newsletter. All right, that's it for us this week. Make sure you stay tuned because we've got a lot of great interviews coming up. And we'll see you all next episode.